I would just say there's one misperception of our veterans, and that is they are somehow damaged goods. Although if we tell our veterans enough that this is what's wrong with them, they may actually start believing it.
Hey everybody, welcome to Dead Reckoning Radio. On this episode, we have Jessica Danger and Amy Sexhour. These two discuss Amy's book, Poppies, specifically the editing process and what it was like to work together and see this project through. Somehow this episode got lost in the archives, but we thought this was as good as a time as any to bring it to y'all, because Jessica and Amy are going to be in Ohio December 9th and 10th doing some poetry readings and a writer's workshop with the National Veterans Memorial Museum. If you're able to make it out there, we'd love to see you, and we hope y'all enjoy this episode.
Perfect. Yeah, I'm still new to the technology part of it. Keith was like, hey, you should host them. And I was like, I have to get a Zoom account. Okay, hold on.
Did you get the free one?
No. Well, no, because I want to, if I want to be able to talk for
More than an hour.
Yeah. So, but it's all right. I don't mind it. I'm not assuming that I'll be hosting podcasts like into eternity. So it'll just be a couple months of pain.
Yeah. Here, you could write it off. Now that you're all of your like publication and writing expenses can be, they're taxable. So
no, I need to write that down.
You are your own business entity.
Actually, last year was the, you know what? I can't remember. It might've been 2020. I want to say maybe it was 2020 was like the first time I got paid for anything creative. And it was like $100 for an article. Yeah. I'm totally blanking now.
Was it OAF?
Yes. Yeah. It was a book review for them.
Yeah. I remember.
Kate
Gaskin, right?
Yep. Yeah. The something war.
The Forever War.
The Forever War. Yep. And I was like, so honored that I had been asked. And like, I put my heart into that article. I was like, so it was such a big deal to me. And it was like, okay, this is the first of many, trying to manifest, right? It's the first of many times I was paid for writing. And then last year I did a couple articles for a couple different organizations, which was cool. But the book came out at the end of the year. So this year is like the first time I feel like I can say I'm a writer without being a poser.
There's a great article. I don't remember who wrote it. It was a personal essay, and it's like the difference between calling yourself a writer and an author. And like, really the only difference is like the social construct of being paid to write something versus actually writing something.
Yeah.
Which makes it a business transaction, not necessarily a creative transaction. And so like, who gets to dictate that, who gets to dictate like, when we're allowed to say we're writers versus when, like, the technical term then would be like, we are paid authors, like someone purchased a piece, but we've somehow folded in the term writer to business transactions, which I continuously remind my students, like, you're already a writer. Like, if you're writing shit, you are a writer.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like the difference between different kinds of art, right? I have a friend who is a really good dancer. Like she's like, we all know she's a dancer. She is like, you can tell by the way she walks that she's a dancer and
floats.
Yeah.
And
whenever we have parties, it's like, we're excited if she's coming, cause we know that people are going to dance cause she'll be the ringleader of dancing.
Is it you? Are you the dancer?
No, it's not. But I do love to dance, but I
know I love it.
I don't have the talent and training that she has, but she probably hasn't. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if she's ever been paid to dance, right? Like mm-hmm. She grew up doing it. I'm sure there's some, competition aspect to it, but like
sure. She'll
always be a dancer. But I don't know how that applies to other arts. I'd be curious to hear like other arts, but like I have a friend be like, so-and-so is a painter. And like, I don't say, oh, have you sold a painting? I would never ask that question, but I put this burden on myself. Like I can't, I remember going through that when I was transitioning off of active duty and kind of trying to figure out like, okay, second life, I'm a mom now. What kind of example am I going to set outside of the army? And, it hit me. Like I think about writing every day. I read every day. I write almost every day. Like I'm a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Like why do I have to prove something to someone else?
Right. Yeah. we're waiting for someone else to validate it. Like there's some jury out there that's like, yep, you now it's official. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it came up in your class too. For those listening, like I took the Dead Reckoning class that you taught, which was amazing.
Yes.
And I'm so glad you're going to keep doing that. I'm so glad.
Mm-hmm. We have one coming up. Actually, it starts at the end of the month on memoir. On the 25th is our first week, so the last week of this month.
Yeah, I've got at least two that I know of. Friends.
Yeah, with. Alex, isn't it? And then yep. And then
Lilia.
Lily. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm so excited for them to be in that class. I totally talked you up too from the last class I took with you.
Oh my gosh, I love it.
So fresh. But it's that idea too of like. I mean, you posted a meme about this, but like in order to get better at your craft, you have to own it.
Mm-hmm.
I think for probably up until I'm 35. So I probably say like up until 30, 32, I was like super passionate, but I would never edit anything because I was like, I'll never show anybody.
Right.
And I'm ashamed to admit it. But now it's like, I mean, I actually have a copy of the edits for Poppies that you did. Like I have it on my desktop. If we wanted to reference any of your edits at any point, I want you to know I have it available.
I love it.
So many of those poems transformed and I love the finished product. I don't know. I just used to have this loyalty to like the first draft. Like sure. I'm not any good unless the first draft is flawless, which is so silly.
It never happens. And it for anyone that also feels this way, which I think I'm sure I mentioned it in the class or I mentioned it in your actual manuscript. Sorry, I'm just grooming my dog while we talk.
I give mine bones in the back, so hopefully they're quiet.
Oh, Layla is our oldest one, and she's just loud. She breathes like a pug, so you'll hear her the whole time. But on first drafts, it's Anne Lamott's essay, Shitty First Drafts, on how, like, she's been doing this for decades. I'm pretty sure she just turned 80. And that essay is like timeless because it's so true on how we have this ridiculous idea that like, it's not good unless the first draft is perfect or like good enough. And when really they're not ever good enough. They're not supposed to be good enough. Like, to me, like that's not, George Saunders has a great quote. He says like writing is revision, right? So revision winds up being like a form of love. Like you love your story or your piece or your craft enough to go back to it. It's just actually like we were talking on Instagram about that meme, about how it's so true about relationships too. Like you have to constantly go back to it and you have to constantly like remain committed to making the best product you can at the end, whether it's writing or revising or parenting or motherhood or relationships.
Literally anything worth your time. I mean, I was just, as you're saying that, I was just thinking like, I literally in yoga class will work on how I breathe. So not even breathing, just something that I don't.
Like, if you don't breathe, you will die.
Yeah. But even that I have to bring attention and awareness to, and I can be better at.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's so true. It's so true.
I have Anne Lamott's Birds by Birds, I think is what it's called.
It's in there. Yep. Shitty First Drafts is in there. Yeah. Bird by Bird.
Mm-hmm. And there's a section, I don't remember, it's been a long time since I looked at that, but I feel like there's this chapter where she gives an example of like just brain dumping, like writing for a couple of pages and then highlighting like there's one sentence in here that's worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of like growth for me to be able to accept that process that like, I just got to get it out and there might be gems in there, but I have to be willing to go through that process.
Yeah. I think a lot of that too, culturally, like particularly in the literary environment, it comes from romantic poets. Like that's how outdated our like societal and cultural perception of artists and writers are, is that like, there's this one person that's just like smiled upon by the gods that is open to receiving beauty. And then it's their job to intuit it to the rest of us who just happen to be like fucking peasants. And that's not true anymore, you know? Yeah. And I think a lot of what we read today in like popular fiction and popular memoir, is the opposite of that. It's that, like, yeah. even the smallest, tiniest things, like, can hold truth and beauty, and that literally everyone has access to it. This just happens to be how we do it. For some people, it might be painting or dance or service, like a whole career in the military might be the best way that they know how to present themselves. And there's literally so many different ways to get to it. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, it's still the idea that the arts specifically are like, you know, you have to be other than. I still at work have students in my intro to genre course and my like beginning poetry course where they literally tell me like day one, oh, I can't do poetry. I'm not that kind of person. Like, well, what does that mean? Like, yeah. can we unpack that? Who is that type of person? Yeah. And they, you know, it's still something that we have to buck up against regularly.
I also have, I don't know if you've heard me say this before, but I want to say, gosh, I can't believe it's 2022. Like, I'm still like in 2021 in my mind.
I know.
So the end of 2020, a lot of this was just my like transition of like being off of active duty for a couple of years. So like the culture that I'm in is different. There's a lot more, you know, freedom for me to like experiment and, you know, see who I am. And part of that's probably just being in your 30s versus your 20s.
Also, yeah, for sure.
I became a mom at the same time. So there's like been a lot of change. And I kind of let myself have this experiment of I read fantasy growing up. That's like my favorite genre, but I, you know, also was like a nerd in school. So I always had to read my schoolwork. And then I joined the army and it was like, oh, these are the books I should read to be a good officer, like leadership books and
sure.
history books. And, you know, when you don't enjoy the book, it takes a while to get through it. So I'm thinking like 1 to 5 books a year, like throughout my 20s. And I would like sneak fantasy books in there. And then at the end of 2020, I was like, you know what? I'm not accountable to anybody. I don't have to tell anyone what I'm reading. I'm just mm-hmm. going to start reading stuff that's fun. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I was like voraciously reading fantasy, sci-fi, romance. I'd never read romance before. Humiliated to admit that in the beginning that I was reading romance. And I read like 120 something books last year.
Oh my gosh. And
I'm on
Do
this.
Do you track thing. Them? Do you keep track of them?
Yeah. Most of them are on a Kindle. I've actually just switched to that to save money. Sure. But like I've got lots back there too. But it's been this journey of like letting myself enjoy this art. And like a lot of the books that I read are like direct to Kindle published, like self-published authors. They're not like big fancy, whatever that means, you know, backed up by a publisher, but like, I'll really enjoy it. And it's like, there's talent and there's beauty and I'm feeling something, but like this person isn't they're not giving the title that a publisher or the money maybe that a publisher right. would give them, the credibility. And so then I look at myself and I'm like, why am I writing? Am I writing because I want some credibility or I mean, obviously money would be nice, but like if I was,
plus.
Yeah, if I was like scribbling into my journal and my diary when I was in the army and it was like a secret dirty thing and I still have that passion, then it's obviously not about the recognition. So I've actually found quite a lot of freedom in my own writing from reading other people be bold and fearless.
Yes. Yes. That's so interesting to me too, because both Keith and Tyler have talked about this, about how they used to hide that they wrote mm-hmm. when they were still in the army. And so I think it's also, I was never in the military, so I don't know, but I think that there must be something there, like culturally. Mm-hmm. And even in those like subcultures in the military, that it's like there's a reason why everyone seems to be hiding it.
But so many creative people are also drawn mm-hmm. to that. I've thought about that too. My perception of it has changed over the years. I think when I was young and I joined and I carried a lot of my like family of origin, you know, burden/trauma or whatever into the military. Mm-hmm. I picked up all the indicators, which were like, your feelings don't serve you here. We need you to be cold. We need you to be calculated. We're going to ask you to do hard things. And like, your feelings are a distraction from that. Mm-hmm. But I learned firsthand that's kind of bullshit. And like, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of people, I almost want to say like the majority, maybe that's not right, but like a lot of people know in the military know that's bullshit. Like when you do hard things with other people, you care about them.
Right.
And like, even if it's just a bromance, right? Like this bro has your back and you guys are super like mm-hmm. cut and dry about how that is. It's still a relationship, but there's still things there.
Yeah. Any kind of service work is relational. Anytime you are in a room with another person, you are in relationship with that person. You can't mm-hmm. avoid it.
Mm-hmm. I read, I had my own experiences of like going on a deployment and like, you know, doing things with my soldiers and asking them to do things and quickly realizing the kind of leadership where you care about each other is more useful and successful than the kind of cold and aloof.
Sure.
So the Army actually did kind of teach me that in its own way, but I read a book, Carl Marlantes, What It's Like to Go to War.
Yes.
Have you read that?
No, but it's fun fact. It's on our nightstand right now, that and Matterhorn, because he'll be at the PB Abate book club in June.
That's amazing. Yeah. I haven't read Matterhorn yet. It's like, it's
a doorstop of a book. That's huge.
It's in front of me on my desk right here.
Oh, I love it.
It's in my, I need to read it. Cause I know it's a classic and I just,
everyone talks about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know he's a brilliant writer. Cause I loved, What It's Like to Go to War. It really opened my mind to a lot of different concepts, but that was one of them, was this idea that like, you know, your warrior people are going to be intimately familiar with death. And so they should be intimately, you know, fluent in life.
Yeah.
And kind of the spiritual space that warriors have occupied in other cultures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of this idea that like the modern American military tried to go the other direction of like, you'll be better killers, you'll be more efficient, you'll be more machine-like if mm-hmm. we, you know, numb that process. And he, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think he's the first person to have these ideas, but maybe the first that was like accessible to us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that totally like blew my mind. I forget when I read that, but it was like after a deployment. So it hit me pretty hard at the time.
I am curious actually, and I don't know that I know this answer, how you came, like, why were you drawn to write poetry if you were reading so much genre fiction? Like why poetry and not fiction yourself?
So I do want to write fiction. So I think what happens is poetry is just what comes out, or at least that's how I interpreted it as a kid. Mm-hmm. I did read a lot of, I read a lot of Psalms as a mm-hmm. kid. I read a lot of Shel Silverstein. Mm-hmm. Even like Dr. Seuss, you know, is very lyrical.
Yes.
So I don't know, like when I had a journal, I just, what came out was like little ditties, little poems, I talked about this in another podcast, but I think it was just me trying to understand my feelings. So I would just like write out how I was feeling, but like in an abstract way to help me understand it. Mm-hmm. But I still really want to write fantasy. Like that's my goal and my dream. And I'm working on it.
Good.
I mean, I learned a lot just in your class, but I think the main challenge right now for me is holding on to a narrative and the characters within it for the duration of, I mean, I tell myself I need to write some more stories because the book thing is real intimidating.
Yeah. It usually scares people away. And it, I mean, I have a completed memoir now, but it didn't start as that. It started as just like, personal essays about like taking care of my dad.
Yeah. And I read about that in an interview you did.
Did you really?
It was one that you posted about making sandwiches. That was the like title.
Oh yeah. I can make a fucking sandwich.
By the way, that resonated with me so hardcore. So that was,
Thank you. That actually, I just, so that woman that posted that, her name is June Gervais and her book is actually coming out. You can pre-order it now. It's called Jobs. Oh shoot, I'm gonna butcher it. Jobs for Very Creative Girls or something like that.
Okay.
And her name is June Gervais. And I've known her forever, but she posted, it's junegervais.com. she posted about that. But her book is about a woman, like a single kind of outsiderish woman growing up in the tattoo industry when it wasn't, you know, necessarily as culturally acceptable for females to have tattoos. So
very cool.
Funny. But going back to my dad and the sandwiches, it was the same as your poems. It wasn't, it was just me like writing what came to me. And so, and for me, it wasn't poems. It was just these kind of like, you know, essays, which also goes back to revision, because my first couple of drafts of that, I was so angry on the page. It was like palpable. It tarnished the whole storyline. And so it took a lot of like just life. And, you know, I'm 41, so I'm old enough now to know like, oh, maybe there's other ways to look at this, you know?
How old were you when you were started writing that kind of thing?
Early 30s. Yeah. I was 33 when my dad went into hospice. So It wasn't, you know, I was still very, very young. And then it took him a very long time to die. So he, you know, and we did a lot of work in that time. I didn't have a relationship with him as an adult. He was an alcoholic. And he drank himself to death. Mm-hmm. And so from 24 to, you know, 32, 33, I didn't have a relationship with him. And so when he went into hospice and I became his sole caretaker, it was not only just like dealing with the like active, like the work of helping someone actively die, but it was also the work of realizing that I had forfeited a whole decade of a relationship with my dad, who I'm now tending to, you know, and all of the like impacted grief that happens there. And
that's
so,
a lot of process.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Yeah. And that's why I didn't see any other available outlets. And all I know how to do is, you know, I always tell people the only way you know how to process the world is through story. Yeah. And for me at that moment in that situation, the only way that I knew how to process it was to write about it. And I didn't realize what I was doing until later when I started seeing how they kind of were sectioning themselves up as essays. Mm-hmm. And then I realized like, oh, I have something here.
I can't wait to read that.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. It's still, actively still looking, you know, please someone take it. But it's actually with a publishing house right now that they're reading through. So we'll see what happens.
Good luck. Okay.
Yeah. But what started me on this tangent, and thank you, is how it came to you as poems, right? Mm-hmm. So you were away processing things as poems. And for me, it came as essays, and how all I was reading was fiction at that time. So I remember when I was pregnant with my youngest son, with Elliot, who's 12 now, I could not read enough. It was when like vampire fiction and stuff was so popular. And
vampire smut right now. So,
oh my God, it was so good. And I remember being terrified that people were going to find out that I was reading it. Like a grown ass woman having her third kid, like reading smut, like novels from the grocery store.
Yeah.
And then going to my work, like teaching people about like, you know, the literary canon of the US. I'm just like, I gotta go. I got a novel in my car that I'm gonna finish. But
have you, I feel like we've talked about this before. Have you read Women Who Run With Wolves?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's wonderful.
So I can't recommend that book enough. I actually feel like I need to reread it again now that I'm saying it out loud. Mm-hmm. But like, I got this idea. I want to say actually going through like, some veteran healing retreats that I worked with in the past and I went through as myself. They're kind of like, you know, they market themselves as like PTSD treatment, but it's really just like a healthy retreat to learn about different coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. A lot of tools borrowed from AA. I know you're familiar with. And then
familiar with AA.
they kind of like introduced a bunch of different stuff with the idea that like something in here is going to stick. Everybody's got different needs. Everyone's in a different place. But one of the really amazing concepts they introduced me to was I think they call it mythopoetics.
Yes.
It's got, but like the first person, I think Joseph Campbell talks about it. I read some Robert Bly, the book I read by him. I'm going to forget what it's called, but it was more aimed at men.
Yes.
But then Clarissa's book was like for women, you know, women,
first one,
mm-hmm. all these myths about women, but this idea that like contained in the bones of these stories is like deep spiritual lessons that can't hit you in any other way, but through a story. Like yes. if somebody comes into their life and you're like, hey, you fucked up, you need to change your behavior. I'll be like, okay, fuck you too. Right. Yeah. But if I read a book and I go on a journey with this character, I'll feel it in a way that I can internalize it. Mm-hmm. And she's got so many great stories in there. And at this retreat, we used to like, I mean, when it was for men, they would do God, what was the myth that they would do with the guys? I can't remember, but there was like a monster in a cage and like they had to like, you know, the kid had to like find the key to get the monster out. And the monster took the kid into the woods and there was like a bucket and they had to like scoop the water. But there's all these metaphors for.
Yeah. That's Beowulf, right? That's yes. Grendel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the archetypal story of like the male hero, right? He has to save himself so that he can save everybody else. And he can't save everybody else until he saves himself. However, I just want to point out that one of the main characters in Beowulf is his mother, the monster, right? So even in like the key core, like male archetypal story,
There's
a very strong, although secondary female character.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, a big deal for me, I feel like I don't want to get too into the weeds of the specific myths because there's so many in that book and people should really read it. But like, it was a huge deal to me to look at the myths as all of the characters in the myth are parts mm-hmm. of your own psyche.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like, I think the first myth in there is Bluebeard, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So Bluebeard's like this creepy dude. He marries a daughter and you know, big surprise, he ends up being shady and like yeah. he's the killer. and like her sisters help her, but then her brothers are the ones that actually kill Bluebeard. Look, Clarissa does such a great job of explaining how the myth is not about a man on a horse coming to save the princess. Mm-hmm. It's about like even Bluebeard, the villain of the story, is in your own psyche. It's the negative voice in your head.
Yeah.
And the men in that story represent like the aspects of masculinity in yourself, which I love how I actually go to this myth a lot because it resonates with me. It's the part of you that has follow through. That's like not just the good idea, but I'm going to stand up and I'm going to do this. I'm going to complete the task. I'm going to make the sandwich, like you said in that article, which again, it makes so much sense. Like you just need to do it. So I look back at my younger self, like writing these poems, and I think it's like I was trying to tap into things that I didn't have normal words for.
Right.
And that like metaphor just was so much cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of being like, mom, I'm sad and I need someone to talk to, I was like, well, it's very rainy today, you know, or whatever.
Yes, yeah.
A little kid poem. It was a lot of a lot about the nature and a lot of children's drama at school was in my, I still have my journals and they're really embarrassing.
I remember when I was 12, my mom for Christmas got me an electric typewriter. So cool. But I also now as a working single mom, I'm partnered now, but for a majority of my time as a mother, I've been alone or unpartnered. I've had so much help that saying I'm alone is not fair, but
I understand.
Yes. The point is that now I understand what a big purchase that was for my mom and like what a sacrifice she made. And I remember it was gray, it was beautiful, and it had like a case that clipped on and stuff. And I remember that whole Christmas day sitting at the table, we had this like breakfast nook that my mom built. She was super handy. She could do like literally anything. She's amazing. She's still my hero. But tomorrow's her birthday, by the way.
Yeah.
And so like sitting facing the picture window that like went out into our front yard, and watching my mom and my brothers and everybody outside with like their bikes and like their Nerf guns and all the other shit that they got for Christmas. and literally just like transcribing, essentially, I wasn't even really fictionalizing anything, like transcribing what I was watching mm-hmm. from the window. Like, and that was my first like short story on that typewriter. And it still confounds me that like, if you would have asked me to stand up and say to my mom, like, mom, this is what I'm experiencing and this is what I'm watching and here's how I feel, I never would have been able to do it.
Yep.
But if you give me a typewriter and you give me the peace and quiet in my home for an hour while everyone's doing something else, mm-hmm. I can present it to you.
Yep.
And like, what a kind of like perfect illustration for what would turn out to be the rest of my whole life, you know? It's so powerful. And I think that that's part of the reason why so many people are so drawn to like fantasy and sci-fi and romance. I think that we discount them too quickly, particularly in like academia and like the like professional publishing world, because we think that they're like their own subgenre or they're less than or whatever. It is so difficult. I coached a student once who's now, we're not only like colleagues and peers, but friends. I'm having coffee with him on Friday. And one of the first things, one of his first projects, he just finished his third book. I mean, he's like a machine. He turned in his like a iPhone for a flip phone so that he would be like less distracted. He's in his 20s too.
That's amazing.
Right. Yeah. And like went and got this like peasant phone so that he wouldn't be distracted by social media so that he could write more. Yeah, like he has sculpted his whole life to just write. And the first book that he did was this like started kind of as like Game of Thrones fan fiction mm-hmm. that wound up being this whole, and he worked his ass off. And I am still so proud of him and that manuscript, because when you write books like that, when you write fiction that falls into the category of like genre fiction, you are building an entire world.
Yep.
That has to be wholly unrecognizable to the one that we live in, but also just recognizable enough that we can relate to it
yeah.
as, you know, culpable and calculated human beings. He came up with, I mean, he drew maps. He wrote an entire language.
Yeah.
Like it blows my mind.
Go ahead, finish.
No, I was just going to say that I don't think that we remember that, or that we see it necessarily on our own without being prompted. That this is a lot of times why it resonates, particularly even also with YA, for that same reason, that mm-hmm. our kids might not necessarily, or our young adults might not necessarily go to school and see it or be able to like disentangle themselves from those strong emotions and identify them. But if they can see it in a book, you know, like however we present them, stories are little teeny tiny empathy machines. That's George yeah. Saunders too. It's our responsibility as parents and adults and educators and creatives to give it to them however we can, and then to allow them to receive it however they can. And sometimes that's vampire smut, you yeah, know?
I agree. Like, I don't know what drew me to the series, to that genre originally. I mean, it might've just been like some of the class. Well, you know what? I'm trying to remember, Lloyd Alexander, The Black Cauldron, I think might've been like the first like chapter book fantasy series that I could read on my own. I think I went right to The Hobbit, and I was like, I read it, but it was kind of hard. So I didn't read Lord of the Rings until later.
I know. It's still tough.
But I'm going to butcher this, but C.S. Lewis has a quote that's something along the lines of like, children are going to encounter villains mm-hmm. in their world, so we should give them heroes. And yeah. I mean it might be out of context, but I took it to be about him writing fantasy. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, who wrote It about the scary clown?
Stephen King.
Yes. Stephen King. Yeah. I'm not a horror fan, by the way. I just want to say that. I can't handle it. I can't handle it at all. I can't read it. I can't watch it. I'm a big baby. I'll confess that. But so I read funny. About even with that story, like the horrific things that each of those children are going through are real things that children experience, and the, and them coming together to defeat this like mythical creature clown is a metaphor for what they really have to do to survive.
Yeah.
And I, even
goes back to the myth theory, right? That the scary monsters in the gutters are just a, another facet of us. It's the same fucking story all the time.
And I would be willing to go toe-to-toe with anyone for every fantasy and romance book I've read. There is something in it that resonates deeply. Like, yes, some of it's just entertaining and some of it's light and some of it's fun. But like, I have discovered by letting myself get into romance novels, I've discovered this whole community of people who read them. And a lot of people, you know, they write stories to, you know, allow themselves to believe in love again, because they've been through some shit where they didn't believe in it anymore. Or they write, you know, characters that they need to write to heal. It's really powerful. And again, even like the sort of light stuff, like you get to know, there's this one author, I can't even believe I'm going to tell you this because it's kind of embarrassing. She writes man on man romance, straight gay romance novels. And they're very like, you have to take a leap of faith, right? Like it's very fiction. It's kind of silly. There's this series about like, God, I'm so embarrassed to admit this, but anyway, it'll meet the intent of the conversation, I promise. So the story is like, there's this guy and he goes around, he finds children that have like sociopathic or psychopath tendencies, and he adopts them. And then he raises them to be like vigilantes, like Batman. Right.
Okay.
And it's again, super leap of faith. Cause we all know that real sociopaths are not fitting this entertaining fiction.
Humbly raising children.
Every book is like one of the boys, it's their love story, their version of love. And it's, again, like I'm reading it and it's like huge leap of faith. It's cute. It's got sexy scenes in it. Like it's a love story. There's a little bit of violence, but it's very like superficial, silly stuff. But then I was reading about the author, and she used to be a nurse in a psychic ward. And her motivation for writing stories is she writes happy endings for all the kids that she worked with that didn't get happy endings.
Dang.
And wow. I'm like, fuck everybody who judges me for reading this. Like, these are also important stories. Somebody needed to write this and somebody needed to read it.
Yeah. Someone out there is going to pick it up and read it and be so pumped that they read it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I love that she does that.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because my 12-year-old is reading Stephen King now.
Okay.
And I go back and forth sometimes. I'm like, bro, you're 12. For school, he just had to finish this, like, they're called like SRI projects or whatever. And so there's this used bookstore that we visit like weekly. It's called Beachtown Books. It's in San Clemente. It's just above Camp Pendleton. It's the best bookstore ever. And they have new and used books, but you can take your, like you get store credit if you bring your used books back to them. And so he just, I mean, that kid can read me under the table. He reads so much and I love it. And so he, plowed through Michael Crichton. He's obsessed with Jurassic Park. Like can tell you like, well, in 86, it was this movie. And then 92, it was this adaption. I'm like, oh, just eat your broccoli, please. But he like read all of Michael Crichton's novels. And then, so he went back to the C section, was like finding some, like praying he had missed something. And he found this other book, Jeffrey Craig or Crace or something like that. And picked up this book. This is my embarrassing story. Picked up this book called A Hostage, comes home, reads it. He's like, that's all he's doing for the rest of the day. And then Keith comes home and he's like, babe, he's reading Hostage. And I was like, I don't, like, we just got a television like 2 Octobers ago. So I was like, yeah, I got it at the bookstore. And he was like, babe. So anyway, he takes his book to school. And it turned out it's like drugs and like abduction and like daughters. I still don't quite understand the plot line. But anyway, he finished it and he's doing his SRI project. And I'm like reading it. And I was like, oh my God, no. bring this in, but fortunately he goes to a really great school and it was fine. But now he is reading Firestarter. That's what it is, by Stephen King, Firestarter. And I remember very distinctly my grandma. I spent a lot of time with my grandma when I was younger, and a lot of where I get my, like, you know, my bookworm tendencies is from her. And she had a library in her back room. She had a piano. She rented a piano for me just so I could practice my piano every day, and had a full library. Like, she had built in, it was beautiful. Mm. It was like my oasis. And the rule was that I could read, if it was in the back room, I could read it. So I really early on was reading like Anne Rice. I read all The Vampire. And then there was another woman who was writing, I can't remember, she's really fallen out of favor, but there was another woman that was writing a lot of vampire romance and stuff like that. And I read all of her. And then I plowed through Dean Koontz and I plowed through Stephen King, like very, very young. I had no business reading it.
Yeah.
And so when he reads this stuff now, I don't really, I mean, there's some stuff, and also like, what a beautiful opportunity for me to sit down and talk to him. Like, yeah. Okay, we're going to talk about what drug lords are. And here's what you should do in a hostage situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't resist.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Do not get in the car under any circumstances. Do not get in the car. But it has always wound up, you know, fantasy and stuff is not for him. And, you know, and then my middle son, my oldest son, he sci-fi and fantasy, that's all he'll read. I mean, he like can go to town, like toe-to-toe with grown-ass adults on Lovecraft.
Mm.
And Oliver, not so much, but Elliot, his thing is horror, and he loves it. So like, why, what am I going to do? Tell him you can't, like, stop it. Don't read that. You know, it's just what he likes, and it's how he finds beautiful things.
I obviously don't understand, like we were talking about earlier, how you were drawn to essay sort of like naturally, organically. Right. And my stuff came out poetry, but it's like, somehow you are reaching for the tools that you need. So yes. Subconsciously, or just like luck of fate or divine intervention, whatever it is, right? They are finding what they need in that art. And I think that's amazing. Speaking of reading inappropriate things too young. So we used to go, I remember like we'd go to the mall and there would be a bookstore. I don't remember what exactly the bookstore was. It was just some, like, you know, franchise that was at the mall.
Yeah.
So I always go to the back and I'd look at the art on the cover of the sci-fi book and the fantasy books, because it was always like beautiful art. And actually I remember there was, you know, there's always like a couple of like hard copies of just art. And I don't remember if the characters were from books or it was just like some artist that made all these like fantasy characters, and I could just sit back there and look at these photos and flip through them while my mom was doing grown-up shopping somewhere.
Right. Yeah.
So I, most of the time I picked out my own books, but you know, my parents would like try to figure out, well, she likes books in the section, so we'll like pick a book for her. So my mom picked this book. Actually, I'm going to show it to you because I have it.
Oh, I love that you still have it.
Well, this is like it's a newer copy because I bought it. But so this is it. It's called Kashiel's Dart. It's a fantasy series. Actually, there's a whole bunch of books now. But like, if you read it, it's basically like, oh, there's this book. This chick. She's a courtesan. She's a spy. You know, she, like, that's kind of like, it's in a made up fantasy world. Mm-hmm. This is a very sexual book. And my mom did not know that. She just like looked at, I mean, the picture's like a little whatever. Yeah,
I would not have guessed that.
I think my mom was looking at it and she's like, oh, like, you know, I don't know. Amy like plays sports and is aggressive and a nerd. And this seems to hit a lot of the points of her being a loner teenager. One of my favorites to this day, still like top probably three favorite book series of all time. Mm-hmm. I do highly recommend it, but like literally the culture of that world is very sexual. Like,
so funny.
It's so funny. Like, it's so funny. So there's definitely stuff in here where I was like, I'm not telling mom what's in this book. I don't want to read this
one. My grandma, God bless her. She's passed away. So this won't embarrass anybody, but myself and maybe my mother, but she's never going to listen to this.
I know. I tell my mom to not listen to
this. Yeah. I'm like, don't do it, mom. Only read the things I send you. My grandma used to keep the joy of sex under her bed, and she would keep a bag of chocolate chips. That's, she hid them from everyone else in the house. So I always knew where to find the M&Ms and where to find the good shit to read after school. And I remember, it's in my book, the day that my mom like finally told me that my mom and dad were getting a divorce, she interrupted me in my grandma's room, fucking mowing chocolate chips, reading The Joy of Sex. And she was like, Jesse Lynn. And I was like, what?
Oh my God, that's so, so funny. So my mom reads historical romance, which is part of the reason why I resisted reading romance for so long, because I associated it with my mom.
Sure.
And thought it was very, and I'm gonna be honest and say I thought it was very uncool. I thought it was very like middle-aged ladies. And like I completely have, you know, been brought around to that. But anyway, I judged the shit out of my mom for reading these romance novels. But you better believe that if she ran into the grocery store and left me in the car and it was sitting like in her purse, I would be like, what's this about? And I'd open up and be like, oh my God, what? But then I'd be curious. Like, well, what is that? What happens? What is, I probably got my sex education from those books, which is not okay. But
oh my gosh. I'm setting high expectations.
Yeah. Right. Well, in my defense, like growing up with the name Sex Hour, like I had to know. For I had to know how to talk shit back to people. So I needed some tools.
For sure. Yeah, I get that.
So I know we only have a couple minutes left.
Oh, I love that we've only just talked about books and not editing at all.
I know. I don't even, like, we maybe mentioned poppies one time, but this is, it's whatever. If Keith's going to let me do it, then he has to deal with the consequences. Hey,
he's a pro at putting up with whatever I run with.
So I want to ask you about poppies and the journey of editing, right? So for me, my first book, I've obviously had people edit like one piece at a time, but I thought like giving this baby to you and having you go through it and see things in it that I didn't see, it was a really powerful, affirming experience for me. And I wanted to get like what that felt like for you. I know you edit a lot of students and stuff work, but
you know what? I love editing and I love working as an editor just as much as I love writing, because it's the same skill. It's just like from a different angle, you know? So for you specifically with poppies, I'm usually my like system is the same. I'll read through it, no pencil or pen in hand, just to like digest it. I just want to receive it with no judgment. I just want to like see it for, you know, where, what it is when I get it. And I remember finishing it and like putting it down and calling Keith and telling him like, yo, this is actually a book about grief and like female love and companionship. It has actually nothing to do with everything else that we have so far in the description. And I sat down at my desk in my office at work on campus and just rearranged them. And I remember once I had rearranged them, the structure was already there, Amy. It just wasn't like, I don't think that anyone had seen it yet. And I also don't think that we, not even just you, but all of us as writers, when we sit down and try to do something a particular way, we can't, you know, like if you had sat down and decided to write about your time in the military as fiction, like it has to be this thing, you wouldn't have gotten there. And if I would have sat down and wrote about my dad, like it has to be linear and, you know, and time constraint, I wouldn't have made it, you know? And it was the same for poppies. In the beginning, your structure was totally different. You had all of your like service poems and mom poems in the beginning. And then it was like a hard stop. And then you had all of your memorial poems at the end. We could have split it. It could have been two totally different books of poetry. But when we look at you entering the, growing up in the military, entering the military, losing your friend, becoming a mom, leaving the military, like settling into motherhood and self-identity, the through line there is relationships. You know, it's not really necessarily service, or, I mean, all of those things are in there. But I think it took kind of like a top-down mm-hmm. approach to be able to see it. And then once I saw it, I knew exactly what we needed to do.
Yeah. I thought it was so, it seems so simple, but it really is kind of brilliant. Like when anyone is in it and you're writing it, right? It's like, you're too in it. Right.
Yeah.
When I sent the manuscript, I literally just did it chronologically. Mm-hmm. And then, like you said, I threw the poems about my friend Ashley just kind of clumped at the end. I might have even like written some of those later. So maybe it was sort of still a little bit chronological. But you, like, it was my journey, but you, as an outside perspective, were able to tweak the order of the poems. I mean, we did a lot of editing too within each poem, but it was like you created the experience for the reader to have mm-hmm. that I could not have done. I just literally was like, this is what I feel. This is the order it happened in. And you yeah. were like, I want to tell the same story, but if we shift it around, the reader's going to get that story better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think time and time again to the things they carried, and that the chapter about, you know, it's fiction, like you make, it's a real thing that happened, but you make it fiction so that it can be received how you experienced it.
Right. Yes.
And I think you did that. And I'm like, I'm very grateful, obviously, for you for doing that, but it was just like blew my mind, like the magic of that process, and like mm-hmm. having another person's perspective made it so much better.
Yeah. And I mean, that takes a lot of trust, you know, yeah. it takes a lot of inherent or implied trust. And a lot of times people don't, that's one of the really cool things about Dead Reckoning mm-hmm. is that they take the editorial process just as serious as anything else. And yeah. they work, I don't edit everything that Dead Reckoning does. They're very particular about who they choose for which project. And I just finished another manuscript, which I won't, for Dead Reckoning, which is coming out soon. And it was not at all the same, you know, ours, your Poppies was the first one that was all women.
Mm.
You were their first female author. And so they really wanted to be like all encompassing for, you know, your illustrator was a female, your editor was a female. It was wonderful.
Yeah. And that was Keith's idea, which I really like. He yeah. came to me with that idea and I never would have asked for that.
Yeah.
But it ended up making a really cool product at the end. And I appreciate mm-hmm. that he said that he saw that.
I loved it. I loved being included in it. I mean, I think it was exciting. But what was the process like for you? Like what does it look like on the other side? Like, what did you,
I mean, I think you hit it on the head, right? It's vulnerable to, like, I've had a couple of different instances with, whether it's just a poem or an article where you have an editor, and I'm always like, look, I can take feedback. Like, I know I'm a woman and I know like creative stuff is very feely, but I'm like, I want hard feedback. Yeah. And I always feel like when I've had male editors in the past, and maybe this is just me, the chip on my shoulder, right? Where I feel like I have to make that known to them. Like, mm-hmm. I want your feedback. I want my craft to be the best that it can. Like, please don't hold back.
Yeah.
But you know, I felt really proud of these poems, and I felt like, you know what? It felt like going on a first date where you know you like the person and like you just got to show up and be vulnerable because it's going to yeah. go somewhere and you just have to trust that.
Yeah.
I haven't been on a first date in like so long, so I'm pulling that out of my ass, but.
Girl, we got to get you on a date.
Someday it'll happen. But yeah, so I felt like vulnerable going into it, but like I'd already had you as an instructor. So I knew a little bit of your story. So I felt like the parts of me that were really exposed and vulnerable in these poems, like I felt like you were a safe place to hold that space. That's not necessarily true for every piece of writing, but for this one, I do feel like that ended up being a big deal to me, that like,
yeah,
saw what I was trying to say. And so I had a lot of faith in you that like any feedback you had about rearranging a sentence or deleting a sentence, because there's a lot of loyalty, right? Like if you're like, there were times where you were like, hey, I think we can cut this. Mm-hmm. And in other circumstances, I might've been like, oh God, but it's my words.
I know. That's the cutting is the hardest part. It's the hardest part. And I know that every single time I suggest it, because I've been on the receiving end. You're like, no, I can't cut that. Like, I worked really hard on that sentence. Yeah. But I've always, it was David Gates, the novelist David Gates, who told me, like, you go back into your story, find your favorite part, and cut it on principle. Yeah. And I, while I don't always cut it, like, sorry, David, I do follow his advice and identify it, because it will show me, you know, what am I really after? Like, what was it about this story? And I'm pretty good at doing that as an editor also. Like, what is this person actually trying to say?
Yeah.
And what else, you know, everything outside of that is extraneous. We just don't need it.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that can be hard to tell someone, like, yo, I know you spent like 46 hours on pages like 215 to 397, but we're going to toss them. Yeah. And you have to rewrite the ending because,
I think so much of being able to get through that is trusting the process.
Yeah.
Going back to like what I read Anne Lamott say in Birds by Birds, it's like, I know that I had to write that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I had to write it this way. Like, I think one example is the title poem, Poppies, I think is the one that changed the most from mm-hmm. the first draft of it to what is in the book.
Yeah.
And I love the final product so much, but I had to write a lot of iterations mm-hmm. for me to process what I was feeling and what I had to say. And it was like having you as the accountability got me through that. Like, I probably would have just given up after like two drafts. Like, you know what? It's a little messy. They're not going to get it, whatever.
Yeah.
But being accountable to you, it was like, no, I want this to capture what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. It takes every draft. It takes as long as it takes. I have people ask me all the time, like, okay, but how many times am I going to have to revise? I'm like, I don't know. It takes however long it takes. But right now I'm just asking you to do this one revision and then we'll see.
There's a quote writing. Oh yeah. I can't remember. I'm so bad at remembering names and quotes, but I want to say it's like from the Talmud or it's from a rabbi. I forget where I found that. Well, I know who sent it to me. A friend sent it to me, but I forget who said it. But it's this idea that like, you're not entitled to the mm-hmm. results of your labor. You're entitled to the labor or
dang.
That's yeah. Horrible. Or the idea that it's, you know, the like sort of cheesy version is like, it's not the destination. It's the journey. Which I've heard that a million times and that never really resonated with me. But this idea that like you get what you need from the work.
Yeah.
You will never really arrive anywhere. Or if you do arrive, like the arrival is bittersweet because it's the end of this journey that you're on.
Right.
And bringing that into awareness of relationships, bringing that into my work life, bringing that into like writing is like, I am getting so much mm-hmm. from the process and I'm not so wrapped up or loyal to this, any sort of outcome.
Yeah. You can't like expectations. Speaking of being familiar with the program, expectations are just resentments, like waiting to bud that you can't.
Yeah.
In anything, the second I start thinking like shoulds or ought tos, I'm a goner. I have to stop and take a few steps back.
Yep.
And try it again. And that's the same for our work, you know?
Well, I can't believe it's already been an hour, but I have to go pick up my daughter from school.
I'm so glad that we got to touch bases.
Yeah. I love talking to you. You're such a fountain of wisdom and experience.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
I'll see. Maybe I can convince Keith to come up with another reason to get you on here.
Hey man, we can just run with it and see what happens and then pitch it to him afterwards.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Before we go though, I wanted on record what you're working on and when you think we can maybe expect it next.
So, oh God. I have so many things. I'm always writing poetry. So I feel like collections are sort of building themselves over time, but I really, I said this earlier, but like, I want to write a fantasy book And yeah. I have figured out, like, I kind of like bit off more than I can chew with going straight from like poems to like this massive fantasy book. So I had one that I started and I kind of backed off and I was like, I want to write, give myself smaller targets. Mm-hmm. So I've decided I want to write a little romance book, just okay. like not, okay. nothing too ambitious, you know, just like a little story. And see if what I can learn from that I can yeah. bring to writing something bigger. So I'd like to have like a draft done by the end of the year.
I'm going to give you, I know you have to go and I'll text this to you later also, but for you, here's my assignment for you. And for anyone else that this sounds appealing to, Ron Rash has in his collection, I think it's All That Glitters Is Not Gold, or it might be in Burning Bright. I think it's Burning Bright. He has his first iteration of a short story. It's called The Woman Who Ran with Jaguars. Okay. So that short story became in his next, or two collections later, became a novella called Mrs. Pembroke. And then that became a novel named Serena. And that he sold the movie publications. The movie is shit. Don't watch it. But sold the movie rights, became a movie. And he just now in his latest short story collection, it's called In the Valley. It just came out last year. He picked up where the novel left off in a secondary short story.
Wow.
So it's the perfect like exercise in starting small.
Yeah.
And not being married to the idea that it has to be this one thing and giving yourself the like creative liberty and like the timeline freedom to yeah. just like, you just have to do this one thing. Yeah. And then if there's more there, then you can, then it becomes longer and longer and longer. And even when you finish the book, you don't have to be done. And like, it doesn't yeah. have to be a sequel. You can just pick up where you left off. So read those.
Okay. I wrote it down. I will.
Okay, good.
All right. Thank you so much, Jessica. It was really great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me and enjoy the rest of the day. Please gin for me.
I will. Thank you.
All right. I'll see you later.
Yeah.
I think the biggest misperception is that somehow we're damning you. But nothing really can stop us.